Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what's today's topic?
Massimo, today we're asking, is it possible to study history scientifically? Are there general laws and principles underlying how history unfolds, and can we infer them from historical data with a level of rigor matching that of the sciences? Here with us today is our first live guest, Professor Peter Turchin, who's a professor at the University of Connecticut in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and adjunct professor of mathematics. He works on the scientific study of historical dynamics, a field for which he has coined the term cleodynamics. He's written three books on the subject, including 2006's War and Peace and War, The Life Cycles of Imperial Nations. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
So just to start off, I have to say my first reaction to the idea of studying history scientifically was that human societies are just too complex, and history being a result of thousands and thousands of different variables and changing over time would just be too infeasible to study it with the kind of rigor that we require in the sciences. I'm sure you've heard that a lot.
Well, in fact, that was my first reaction too. Remember, I was trained as a biologist, and I became, well, a cleodynamicist only in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it started really as a hobby. I thought about some history of biology, the work of people such as Vito Volterra and Alfred Lotka, and how useful were the mathematical models that they designed, how useful they were in the study of population dynamics. So I thought, well, let's try and see what might happen. And it was just a lark. But then, as I started delving deeper into the subject, because I can't just work on mathematical models, I am immediately curious as to how these mathematical models might relate to data, to reality. So I started looking for data to test the models. And to my great surprise, I found, first of all, that there is a lot of data. We can talk about that later if you wish. But more importantly, that there are very strong empirical patterns. And when you have strong empirical patterns, that suggests that there may be some general principles, laws of history, if you wish,
so Peter,
that underlie these patterns.
We'll get to a couple of examples soon so that our listeners can get a better grasp of the kind of things that you're doing with this approach. But from what I hear, this is therefore significantly different from, say, another famous biologist who did some scientific approaches to history, which is Jerzy Diamond's work, right? So do you see that as your work as a continuation of the kind of approach, or, as I suspect, actually something quite different?
Well, no, I see us working towards the same goal. Both he and I are looking for general patterns, and also we are looking for general explanations that underlie these patterns. Jerzy Diamond's book is a wonderful piece of scientific writing. It's very.
We should say that's Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yes,
right?
Well, both.
And also Collapse.
Right? Yes, I actually like Guns, Germs, and Steel better than Collapse. Although Collapse is a wonderful book too. Diamond, on the other hand, does not push this approach as far as I and my colleagues wish to push it. So he throws out wonderful hypotheses and brings up some very suggestive data that may support explanations that he proposes, but he doesn't bring the whole power of the scientific method to the study of history, I would say.
Because he's not quantitative enough, you think?
Yes, well, it's more than that. So briefly, the tried and old tried and true scientific method is you have to design alternative hypotheses, right? Yes. Competing hypotheses, competing explanations for how nature or societies operate. And then you go and you find data that allows you to distinguish between the predictions of these two alternative hypotheses. That's basically a scientific experiment in a nutshell. Essentially, a scientific experiment is not about messing around with nature, although many of them are manipulative, so-called manipulative experiments. The experiment is really about distinguishing between two or more alternative hypotheses on the basis of data.
But an interesting objection that could be raised to this, and I don't want this discussion to go too far afield, and actually I want to go back to explore one or two of your examples. But a reasonable objection to this approach could be that, well, there are even very well-established fields in science where that method that you just described doesn't seem to work very well. The obvious and most controversial one these days is superstring theory in physics. My understanding is that there's something like 200 general families of versions of this theory, none of which makes any empirically testable prediction, at least at the moment. If sometimes it's so difficult to make precise empirical predictions in areas that are clearly scientific, such as fundamental physics, I can see somebody say, well, and you want to do that in history? So how would you do that? Can we get to one example of how you do that?
Well, I'm pleased to hear that it turns out that historical theories are easier to test than some physical theories. I think...
Funny thing, huh?
Yes. Well, I think that there could be no science without empirical testing of theories, right? Empirical testing of theories. That's basically the heart of science. And, well, the problem with string theory is that basically they need very high energies, as I understand. I'm not a physicist myself. Right. So, in principle, it's still science because it's testable, right? It's just maybe they haven't figured out a way how to test it. In history, on the other hand, it is actually not that difficult to test theories. We do it all the time.
Can you give us a specific example of your work then? What is it that you found out that it's interesting for the general public, let's say?
And can you tell us how you actually go about testing a theory? Is it possible to get new data in history, given that it's all in the past? Does it rely on us discovering new things we hadn't already discovered?
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about scientific prediction. Scientific prediction doesn't have to be about the future, all right? Since in science we aim at understanding, prediction is basically an intermediate step that we use to test alternative hypotheses. We extract predictions, different predictions, the predictions that clash about some aspect of reality from two alternative hypotheses, and we go and take a look and see what does the reality conform to predictions of one hypothesis or the other one. So there is nothing that has, it doesn't have to happen in the future. And that means that in many historical fields of science, such as history, geology, evolutionary biology, astrophysics, these are legitimate branches of science. They don't allow manipulative experiments, but they allow what's called as measurative experiments, which is what I have described.
I think that's an interesting point, if you don't mind, for a second, we should emphasize for our listeners, which is this is a common misconception about science. There are several common misconceptions about science, one of which is that it has to have to include experiments, and that's not the case. What you call manipulative experiments. You can do perfectly good science by observational testing of hypotheses. But the other very common misconception is that predictions are in fact about the future. Of course, in everyday language, that's the meaning. Usually, that is the meaning of the term. You know, if you predict something, it's about something in the future. But you're right. In science, predictions actually can be about past events that have already occurred, and they are therefore predictions about the discovery of particular kinds of evidence that are supportive or not of a particular hypothesis. You mentioned historical sciences such as evolutionary biology and, for instance, paleontology. And paleontology does provide us with one of the best examples of historical science when people finally figured out that there was, in fact, a large impact 65 million years ago that probably contributed quite a bit to the demise of the dinosaurs as well as a lot of other species. Well, initially, this was just a hypothesis, was just a possibility. But in fact, several pieces of crucial evidence were found after the hypothesis was formulated. And it is one of the best examples of historical science that has been established on hypothesis testing. So it's clear that you can, in fact, test hypotheses about the past. What about human past then?
Right. In fact, there is a word for it. Some people call it retrodiction, where you make a prediction about some pattern in the past. The best way to approach this is to actually predict something that you don't know. And there is no chance, no possibility for you to know. So, for example, ideally, the way we would do it in Clio Dynamics is that we will generate predictions and tell archaeologists, well, this is an ideal situation, remember. Okay, dig there and find out what is actually the case. That would be a completely ironclad example of scientific prediction, because there was no way ahead of time for us to know what is under, 2 meters of dirt in that particular location. All right? So we haven't yet got to that point, but I don't see why we shouldn't in fairly near future. So let me give you some examples of how we go about testing theories meanwhile. So, well, let's, for example, take, there is one very general pattern in history, which we call secular cycles. Secular cycles. So it turns out that historical societies are affected by recurrent waves of political instability that tend to happen every couple centuries or so. And so, essentially, historical societies go through these very long-term oscillations, which have, we may divide this each oscillation into two phases, the integrative phase and disintegrative phase. The integrative phase, about a century long, or sometimes longer, is characterized by internal peace and stability, population growth, and general optimistic outlook of the society. And disintegrative stage is the vice versa. We have a lot of civil war and other kinds of political instability. Populations either stagnate or even decline, sometimes even collapse. And there is a lot of pessimistic ideologies that actually are present in the society. So we have this very general pattern. Predictions could be made at several different levels. First of all, you could say, well, this is a general pattern that should affect any agrarian society, any society that is a state which is large enough to develop under its own power, so to speak, due to its internal dynamics, should go through these cycles. And so the way to test that prediction at the empirical level is to look into other regions of the world compared to the ones where we developed this theory, right, and see if something like that happens. And that's actually how it has been done. For example, maybe we'll talk later about Southeast Asia, a region about which I didn't know anything. And it turns out that there is a very interesting historian specializing in Southeast Asia who has discovered exactly the same pattern.
But Peter, the question then that arises from the example you were just explaining is that I think plenty of people might grant that there are patterns that you can quantify, which certainly is something that historians themselves should be doing or are interested should be interested in doing. But there's, of course, a difference between identifying patterns or quantifying patterns and, in fact, testing causal hypotheses. That seems to me the more tricky step in the case of human history, right?
How do you I agree. So let's talk about, there are several alternative explanations that explain why we have these repeating oscillations. By the way, they're not perfect cycles. They vary in period somewhat, but we can talk about that later. So we have two alternative hypotheses. One of them is the Malthusian model. It suggests that as population increases to the point when it starts pressing on its resources, popular immiseration increases, and that directly brings about instability, warfare, which decreases population, and the cycle can start again. So we have the cycle which is driven purely by demographic mechanisms. The alternative theory, it's called demographic structural theory. It also has the demographic growth as a component, but it assigns more importance to what happens to the other two components of the social system, namely the elites. These are the people with power. So think about nobility of the medieval France. And what happens to the state? In the demographic structural theory, the wave of instability happens not because population is miserable. because peasants in those agrarian societies didn't have much military power, and peasant rebellions were easily crushed as long as the elites were unified and the state was strong. What actually happens is that there is a problem called elite of reproduction. There are too many elites who are fighting for the diminishing slice of the same pie, and the state becomes weakened. So it is when the state loses the ability to pay for the army, police, and so on and so forth. And by that point, the elites have already got to the point where they are riven by rival factions. That is when actually basically everything starts to break down. The state loses the ability to control the internal order, and the elites, the rival factions of elites start civil wars. All right? So there's two alternative theories. How can we test them? Well, we can test them by looking at the actual sequence of events. You know, you can take a look at what happened in the medieval period, in the late Middle Ages in, say, England or France. There was a very strong population growth during the most of the 13th century. And by the beginning of the 14th century, we had a very strong Malthusian situation. Starvation, popular immiseration, and everything. But there was no really breakdown of the state, and there were no civil wars. It really took the additional push of the Black Death, which decreased the population. As a result, the social pyramid, because the elites were much less affected by their mortality. The social pyramid became top-heavy. There were too many elites for their sort of, so to speak, supportive base. And so as a result of that, the whole society was thrown into disorder, and that is when actually you had all the civil war started. And then vice versa. Once the, in the Malthusian explanation, once the Black Death destroyed about half of the population, you should have seen the resumption of the demographic growth and the whole cycle should start again. But that's not what happened. For another 100 years or so, English society and French society experienced a series of civil wars. And the population never grew. It actually declined and stagnated. So it really was that other two factors, the elites and the state, that that were responsible for the this long period of civil wars, for example, such as...
So you would count that as is sort of a falsification of the Malthusian hypothesis.
That's right. And that's so this is an example of what I was talking about, where the data is actually is supportive of the predictions of the demographic structural hypothesis, but it contradicts the predictions of the Malthusian model.
What was the theory developed using that data, or is that new data? Because the key to making predictions is not, as Massimo said, it's not about data from the future. It's just data that we didn't already have when we were developing the theory. That seems
precisely. So what we do next, we actually now apply the same theoretical predictions to other societies. And what we find, if you look at Roman Republic, late the transitional period between the Republic and the Empire, we find very similar pattern. Again, about 100 years of civil wars, and in fact, the evidence for demographic pressure on resources isn't terribly strong, but the evidence for elite overproduction is very strong. So we just go and test the theory in a variety of case studies like that.
So, Peter, as you might imagine, this kind of topic brings up a lot of comments. We usually post a teaser for the podcast before the actual we type the actual episode, and we have several interesting comments, and we may get to discuss a couple of them. Julia, what did you find going through that?
Well, one commenter, Phi Willie, said that it's the black swans, the really unpredictable events that, as far as he can tell, have the major impact on the future. He says historians are pretty good at finding plausible after-the-fact explanations of why things happened, but they nearly always miss the big factors when they extrapolate to the future, such as World War I, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the housing bubble, 9/11, et cetera, and those are the events that really change the course of history. How does that fit into your description of sort of universal repeating patterns?
Yes, obviously, black swans is something that happens all the time. I would not overemphasize the importance of such events, because basically dynamical systems come in a variety of guises and shapes. Some of them are characterized by this runaway type of things like earthquakes and, you know, collapses of the stock exchange. They're characterized by black swans. In other situations, you have more types of stable cycles and things like that.
But I wonder if even the black swans, that's an interesting point, but I wonder if even the black swans are not amenable in fact to quantitative analysis. For instance, there is an analogy in paleontology where paleontologists have identified a number of more or less recurring mass extinctions, and a mass extinction certainly is an unusual event. I mean, by definition, it happens only every several tens of millions of years. It has a huge impact and so on, and yet, since the historical record is long enough, we have actually observed several of these in the fossil record, and then there are patterns, and that you can start making some interesting hypotheses about why these occasional events occur. So while you cannot predict necessarily the next event when that's going to happen, you can perhaps pick up a pattern on that.
Yeah, that's right. So, for example, let's take wars. The magnitude of war has a power law distribution, so it is a type of a black swan, because sometimes wars really get out of hand. All right? So, but there were thousands and thousands of wars in human history. So, first of all, we can study them statistically. That's why we know the distribution of war intensity follows the power law curve. But also, even though we may not be able to predict the amplitude, right, the intensity of any particular war, right, like we cannot predict ahead of time the intensity of the next earthquake, still, we can do lots of useful things. We know, for example, where earthquakes happen, all right, along the fault lines. And so the same thing, whether a war is any society is likely to go, say, into internal war or not. Now, the demographic structural theory I was describing to you, that actually makes pretty strong predictions about the timing and dynamics of such events, internal wars.
You mentioned these statistical distributions that you can derive. And one of our commenters, Costas, talked a lot about how much data might be necessary in order to test these theories. And I'm wondering, you know, we hold scientific theories to high standards of rigor. Like they, you know, scientific phenomena have to be statistically significant in order for us to accept them. So what role does, say, statistical significance play? Is there really enough data?
It's absolutely a crucial role. Because without statistical significance, you cannot really. Everything is, we are talking about stochastic, or at least events, dynamics, which are affected by stochastic factors, and therefore we have to use statistics to test theories.
Great, thanks, Peter. It's fascinating. Now, however, it's time to move on to our rationally speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode of the Rationally Speaking podcast features picks by Julia and myself, but this time we have a live guest in our studios, and we decided to do it differently. We'll have our guest, Professor Peter Turchin of the University of Connecticut, doing the pick of the episode.
Well, my suggestion was a book by a Michigan University of Michigan historian, Victor Lieberman. It's called Strange Parallels. The reason I just finished reading this book, it actually comes in two volumes, and I just finished reading volume two. And the reason I'm suggesting it is because this book talks about strange parallels in more senses than one. Well, the original meaning of the title is that Victor Lieberman is a specialist in Southeast Asian history. And he observed that societies that he studies, such as Thailand, Burma, and Vietnam, went through a series of oscillations that are very similar to some of the oscillations that we observe in other Eurasian societies, such as China, France, Russia, and so on and so forth. And so he wrote these two volumes. One of them is almost 1,000 pages long, detailing in high detail the similarities that we observe between the dynamics of such different regions in the world. And the reason I thought this would be an interesting pick is because here's an example where somebody working very independently of the stuff that I and my colleagues do actually hits on a very similar both patterns and explanations of historical dynamics. So this suggests to me that there is something something real in what we study.
Peter, so I noticed something interesting, however, in the description of Lieberman's work, which is that these cycles are also appear to be synchronous even among civilizational populations that are not in direct contact with each other, which suggests some kind of internal dynamics rather than a mechanism that synchronizes things across populations. Now, I noticed that there is a panel there with ecology and evolutionary biology, where there is always a debate about the relative importance of internal dynamic factors affecting dynamics versus external factors, right? So if there is, so what is the idea here? What might be the kind of internal factors that might synchronize these cycles across civilizations?
Well, there are two sort of alternatives. One of them, that there is an external driver that actually affects societies as far, you know, flung apart as Europe and Southeast Asia, and that external driver actually produces these synchronized cycles. The other possibility, and even more exciting one, is that each society goes through cycles because of endogenous internal dynamics. And then these cycles get synchronized by some external cues. The difference being that in the first case, the external driver is actually cyclic. In the second case, the cyclicity comes internally, all right, but then different cycles get entrained because of shared environment. All right, so this is one of the, here is a set of two alternative hypotheses that we could actually start testing with data. And we have started doing that.
It's an interesting experience that your theory was strengthened by the fact that you didn't know ahead of time about this research. So I'm wondering if this experience is an argument in favor of extreme specialization in history. Like, should you really only study one particular field so that the theories that you generate are sort of uncontaminated by the data from the rest of the world or other periods of history? What do you think? What did you draw from this experience?
Well, Victor Lieberman is a very unusual historian. Actually, historians have largely repudiated the search for general patterns and laws of history. They think there's nothing such thing.
That history is just one damn thing after another.
Yeah, sort of. But then they wouldn't say that, but they say that everything is different, every society is different, every period is different, and in fact, well, most historians don't even call themselves scientists. They are humanists, right? And humanists have a very different set of priorities. So Lieberman is quite unusual in this respect. He, of course, is very careful. He actually pays, he talks about how each society is different, but then he comes over and drives at the similarities, and that's very unusual for historians.
Thanks, Peter. That's all the time we have for this episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.